Now and again you still hear an Andrews Sisters record on the radio. Whenever I hear them, I'm always reminded of the Rich Brothers. I met up with them first when I was filling in as a theatrical touring manager soon after the war. The show was a sophisticated pre-war comedy, but unfortunately, as I said, the war was over. Tastes had changed. We were billed as prior to the West End, but it would have been truer to say prior to oblivion, for the nearest we ever got to the West End was the old Hippodrome, Golders Green, which of course has long since been gobbled up by the BBC, whose judgment in this respect it would obviously be professional suicide for me to question. The play was never heard of again, but in spite of its complete failure, I look back on the tour as a very happy one. Sometimes it's like that. There are pre-London tryouts that are headaches from the very first day of rehearsal to the last night in town. Other times, everything ticks over like a well-oiled machine. Quite likely the end result is the same, 2 weeks and finish. There's no telling. Anyway, the point is that the Duke of Deauville was one of the latter tours. Happy. All of us fated to be out of work at the end of it, but oblivious. Every week was a sort of holiday, particularly if you had good digs. At their best, theatrical digs were a home from home. Better than a lot of people's homes. And the very best of all were in Bradford. Mrs. Winthrop's. They were not just the best in Bradford, they were the best anywhere. In fact, the only thing against them was that they were in Bradford. Mrs. Winthrop ran her place like a miniature hotel. Spotlessly clean, wonderful meals, full board, and no chat. This last is always a bonus. Landladies can be a pain. There were some who talked as a form of therapy, rabbiting on endlessly about their husbands' shocking character faults, their gallbladders, ungrateful daughters-in-law, Manchester United, you name it. Sometimes, of course, they were very indiscreet and told you all about the various stars of stage, screen and radio who'd stayed with them in the past and their scandalous behaviour. I admit that this tittle-tattle could be diverting, particularly if the people being betrayed were known to you personally, but on the whole, a landlady who provided clean, comfortable rooms and kept quiet about the house until 11 a.m. and was ready with a hot and appetising meal when you got back from your show 12 hours later, well, she was good news. Provided, and this was a pet hate of mine, there were no little notices placed all over the house. Please leave the toilet as you would wish to find it. Pull slowly and hold down before releasing. And baths by arrangement, sixpence. No towels. One place I stayed, there was a note pinned to the pillow. It gave statistics of people burnt to death smoking in bed. But Mrs. Winthrop was perfection. I suppose there must have been a Mr. Winthrop sometime or other. I never heard him mentioned, and I never asked. You never know when a question like that can open the floodgates. But there was a son, Eric. When I first stayed there, he was a neat little chap in short trousers. He'd be standing at the front door when the pros arrived, hair smarmed down, face scrubbed, collar and tie. He'd help with the bags. Wouldn't accept a tip. A pleasure, Mr. Kingsley Platt, he would say. Perfect manners. Mrs. Winthrop was justifiably proud of him. He was in the choir at the local church. He was a Boy Scout. He was studying to be an accountant. He'd keep out of the way during the week until the time came for us to leave, when he would again help with the baggage. He grew up into a very good-looking young man. He was 20 at the time I'm going to tell you about. Tall, slim. He helped us with the bags, as usual. Now, there are a lot of landlady's daughter jokes, most of them in very poor taste, and on arrival, thinking she'd be pleased and flattered, I made some light-hearted remark to Mrs. Winthrop about her having the male equivalent of the legendary landlady's daughter. I can't remember exactly what I said, but I clearly remember it didn't go down at all well. It occurred to me then, for the first time, that Mrs. Winthrop had never had anyone of the fair sex staying with her when I'd been a guest. I came to the conclusion then that she didn't want her son Eric, her pride and joy, fraternising with any loose-living theatricals. In other words, she was the classic overprotective mum. But I didn't think about it for very long. Too much to do. Right. Now, having tried to give you a picture of Mrs. Winthrop, I'll tell you about the three rich brothers. Only two were real brothers. Eccentric comedy and music. They were very successful at the time I'm talking about. They toured the States, Europe, Australia. Stan Rich, the eldest, more or less inherited the basic act from his father, who'd also worked a three-handed act on the halls. But the sons adapted it and added to it. The Rich brothers, as I remember them, presented a mishmash of stolen material, but it worked. It was fast and slick and sure-fire. They had excellent musical arrangements. They never took risks. Imagine three men in white suits. Tight trousers, bowler hats a bit too big, so they came down to their eyebrows, all three with Charlie Chaplin stuck-on moustaches, a phone box in the middle of the stage, and they sort of fight each other to get into it. One gets in, and then the other two make friends with each other and take the side off the phone box and drag it away so the one making the call is left in the open holding the phone. They cut the wire. He goes on talking. Then somehow he gets back and pulls the box together again. The others pull the wire and it falls over on its side. The other two put their bowler hats on the horizontal door and say a prayer as if it's a coffin. And so on. There's a lot of hurry music going on all through this. Plenty of work for percussion. I don't expect this makes a lot of sense to you, but believe me, when I saw the original French version in Paris, Les Trois something or other, it brought the house down. Stan Rich must have seen it too, because he incorporated it into their act. He also stole the idea of miming to an Andrews Sisters record from a well-known American act. The three Riches would have to leave the stage for this. It took them about 5 seconds to change into gingham dresses and blonde wigs, and during that 5 seconds they trained a small dog to walk on the stage, sniff at the phone box, and cock his leg up against it. Always got a round of applause. A moment later, the phone box would collapse, an idea they picked up from a nightclub act in Berlin. It always got a huge laugh. And then on the crest of it, the Andrews Sisters part of the act. It always went like a bomb. After a couple of numbers, they'd tear off their gingham dresses and the wigs and go into their finale revealed as three good-looking blokes with quite acceptable voices, singing current hits. They sang well enough to have been a straight singing trio, but the comedy lifted them into another bracket. That week in Bradford, all four of us were staying at Mrs. Winthrop's, and I slipped in to see the Riches doing their stuff at the Alhambra Second House Monday. They tore the place apart. But I have to admit, I didn't really warm to them. There was no spark. I missed any real sense of fun. It was all too calculated. They seemed to have learned to trigger laughs. And in spite of all the applause they generated, I think audiences realised this. They were willing subjects, as it were. But when they left the theatre, I think that was the end of their pleasure. With Sid Field and Jimmy James and a few more, Max Miller certainly, people would leave the theatre laughing and talking about them, and some of the magic would last them the rest of their lives. But not so with the Rich Brothers. Anyway, afterwards, I went round to see them, and we had a couple of beers in their dressing room and then went back to Mrs. Winthrop's for supper. It was always worth going back to. Landladies often complain about artists being late for meals, but they never seem to realise that the meals they provide do not exactly beckon. Anyway, we all had a very pleasant time. The Riches told me all about their recent tour of Australia. The youngest, the one who wasn't a brother, had had a romance with a girl in Brisbane. The other two pulled his leg about it. We had a few laughs at his expense. We exchanged reminiscences of an amorous nature, and we went to bed. Next morning, Stan and Alan Rich went off to play golf, and I left for an understudy rehearsal. I got back in time for what I thought would be a quiet lunch prior to a refreshing napette. But I opened the front door to find the house vibrating with high drama. Stan Rich was on the phone in the hall. His brother Alan was pacing up and down beside him, puffing furiously at a cigarette. The dog was barking because he sensed something was amiss. Mrs. Winthrop poked her head out of the lounge and pulled me inside. "He's on to his agent," she said, "because the young ones run off. Went as soon as they left to play golf. Left a note saying he's going back to Australia. Some girl, I believe." Then she gave a sort of sniff. It seemed to confirm the impression I'd got on my arrival. Mrs. Winthrop hadn't much time for her own sex, or for men's interest in it. But neither this nor the commotion Stanridge was creating in the hall prevented her from serving an excellent lunch. I was enjoying the crab salad with homemade mayonnaise when in came Stan and Alan. "You've heard," said Stan. I nodded. "You've got to help me. We're in a terrible spot." "What can I do?" I said. I asked the question not as an indication of willingness to do anything about it, but because I just couldn't think of any way I could help. I was rather flattered when Stan suggested that I should take over the role of the missing brother, but as soon as the words were out of his mouth, I realized I didn't have the dancing or vocal skills required. I might have had a shot at the comedy, though it would have been quite outside anything I'd done before, but I didn't tell him that. I merely explained that my first loyalty must be to my own management, and I could not leave them without anyone in charge, even for an evening. Stan just rattled on. "Alan and me could get anyone through. That git who's left us in the lurch was a novice when he started. By the second house he was one of us. Right, Alan?" Alan nodded and said the act was foolproof. "Yes," said Stan, "but it had to have three to work it. And if I tell our management we can't go on tonight, they may cancel our bookings for the next 3 months." I made what I thought was a helpful suggestion. "One of the strengths of your act is the straight singing at the end. Why not add a few more numbers to make up the time and just do a straight musical act without comedy or anything that requires the three of you?" Stan barely let me finish. "That would not be the Rich Brothers," he said. "We're contracted to appear as known. We should be in trouble. But here you are, an experienced performer." I had made the mistake the night before of exaggerating what I'd done on the boards. "You're an actor. I thought actors could do anything." "I wish I were free to help you," I said. "Bloody actors," he said. "Snobs, that's what they are." There's often this ridiculous prejudice between variety and legitimate performers. Not the top-liners. They always recognise talent, regardless of anything else. I could say more about that, but some other time. Just as Stanridge made that unfortunate remark, I heard Eric Winthrop come in. I had a sudden inspiration. I said to Stan, "What about Eric? He used to sing in the choir, and him having been a Boy Scout, he probably still likes to do the occasional good turn. Perhaps he could do you one." But I hadn't finished the sentence before the two of them had rushed out. They ran upstairs to Eric's room. Presently I heard a lot of shouting, including the raised voice of Mrs. Winthrop, unusual that. She was obviously very upset. I'd just finished a piece of her apple and sultana flan with real egg custard when she came in with the coffee. She looked ruffled and her eyes were red. I opened my mouth to speak, but she held up her hand to stop me. She put down the coffee, cleared the dirty plates, and went out without a word. As she opened the door, I heard the sound of three voices harmonizing upstairs. Mrs. Winthrop gave a sniff and disappeared into the kitchen. It was obvious that my suggestion had borne fruit. After about an hour, Stan and his brother came downstairs, and Stan spoke to me over his shoulder as they went out the front door with Eric. "Going to rehearse the comedy business down at the theatre," he said. Eric gave a thumbs-up sign, and off they went. Not a word of thanks for the suggestion, but that is par for the course. Now, when I offered some advice to Sir Alexander Corder in the wake of the I. Claudius debacle... But no, that is another story. Later that evening, curiosity getting the better of me, I was able to slip away from the Prince's along to witness the debut of Eric Winthrop as a Rich Brother. It's hard to describe. I've told you about the act already, an act with comedy business, dancing, singing, miming in drag. An act, moreover, polished to a slickness rarely seen in this country or even in the States. Well, with this new recruit, who, remember, had never been on the professional stage in his life before, and had had a bare 4 hours rehearsal, there was no difference. It was the same act I'd seen the night before. It was depressing in a way, because it gave the lie to the legend of how hard the work is and what patience and dedication go into any sort of success. But I have to admit it worked. Two things were in their favour, of course. One was that, as Alan put it, the act was foolproof. The other was that Eric didn't have a nerve in his body. It seemed so extraordinary to me, still does, that this young man was able to just slip on a gingham dress and a long blonde wig, with a perfectly straight face and no sign of embarrassment or inhibition. And when they whisked off the dresses and wigs for the finale, he was actually better than the other boy had been. Had a better voice and a fine sense of rhythm. The Alhambra manager was standing at the back of the stalls as I left, and I nodded to him. "Great act," I said. Although we both knew he had nothing whatsoever to do with booking it, he gave a proprietary smile. "They never miss," he said. He didn't even know there'd been a change of cast. I went back to attend to my work at the Prince's. It didn't take long to fill in the returns. A mere 48 people had ignored the advice of the Guardian critic and had turned out to see the Duke of Deauville. I told the cast to cheer up, business was building nicely, and went back to Mrs. Winthrop's. She wasn't there to give the customary welcome, but she had laid on a first-class cold collation with all the trimmings and put a nice bottle of Suave on ice by way of apology for the meal not being hot, and a short note saying she hadn't been able to cook owing to circumstances beyond her control. Sometime later, after their second house, Stanrich and Alan arrived with Eric. They brought a couple of bottles of champagne by way of celebration, and they gave me at least two glasses. Of course, they were glowing with success. "Don't tell me," I said. "I saw it all first house." "Amazing! Congratulations, Eric. You are a real pro." I looked across at Stan. "One of my better suggestions, hmm?" "What?" he says. "What?" He'd completely forgotten who had suggested Eric. Well, that's happened to me a lot. People forget so soon. Anyway, the unbelievable happened. Eric Winthrop became a star overnight. Now, I'm exaggerating. Let us say he changed from being a young office worker who was studying to become an accountant into a third and important part of a very successful variety act. Mind you, Eric met with a lot of opposition before he decided to ignore his mother and accept Stan's offer. He knew nothing about the economics of show business, and so he thought the money sounded good. After all, 40 quid was quite a lot in those days. And the offer came just at a time when Eric was disenchanted with his accountancy studies. So the idea of working for 20 minutes twice a night and seeing the world at someone else's expense was a lot more attractive than poring over ledgers from 9 to 5 and never leaving Bradford, and his mother's strict surveillance. So Eric agreed to join the Rich Brothers on a permanent basis. Mrs. Winthrop was very subdued for the rest of that week. She continued to function as efficiently as ever. I suppose in her own way she was as much a pro as any of us, but I could tell it was a considerable effort. She never went along to the Alhambra to see Eric. What passed between them during those 5 nights before Eric left with the Riches, I do not know. But there must have been some bitter exchanges. I suppose she'd seen too much of theatricals at close quarters to be anything but depressed about her son choosing the life himself. I suppose it pretty well broke her heart. Eric, on the other hand, thrived on the showbiz atmosphere. He even embellished the act with one or two touches of his own. Well, not really his own, bits he picked up from other acts on the various bills they shared, and also from a Jerry Lewis picture that was a big hit at the time. Eric worked up a passable imitation of Jerry Lewis and incorporated it into the act. Stan didn't mind this. He didn't care who got the laughs and applause, so long as the act worked. Well, Stan was a businessman. But not, definitely not, as good a businessman as Eric Winthrop. And the day Eric discovered that Stan was being paid $400 a week and only passing 10% of it in Eric's direction, then the days of the Rich Brothers were numbered. First, Eric put it to Stan that as the act was earning $400, about $2,000 in today's money, he, Eric, was surely entitled to a third of it. Stan was firm. He pointed out a few age-old showbiz clichés to the effect that Eric had been an unknown when Stan had discovered him. Stan, who had never had an original thought in his head, probably told Eric that he'd plucked him out of the gutter and made him a star. He pointed out how easy it had been to find him as a replacement when the previous Rich Brother had absconded in Bradford. He believed he would be just as lucky again. But by the end of the week, he'd relented. He probably had a word with his London agent. Anyway, he offered Eric another fiver. Too late. And too little. Eric had already made his arrangements. After the show on the Saturday night, he took the train to London. Unperturbed, Stan and Alan went up to Scotland for their next booking. Their agent sent a replacement. But when the three of them met in Glasgow and Stan explained the Andrews sisters' routine and the gingham dresses and wigs, his sexual insecurity got the better of him and he got the first train back to London. In fact, with the departure of Eric Winthrop, the Rich brothers were finished. Meanwhile, in London, Eric got busy. He hired and rehearsed two very attractive girls in his own version of the Rich Brothers act. Girls are usually cheaper and they work harder because of the greater competition, you see. So I'm sure Eric enjoyed auditioning them. And he picked out two real crackers. Nevertheless, on stage, their charms were hidden beneath the same style suits as the originals. Same bowler hats, a bit too big, and the same Charlie Chaplin moustaches. They opened with the same phone box routine. They trained a dog to pee against the phone box, and to save tipping a stagehand, Eric cut out the box collapsing and substituted a sunflower growing up the side, which he worked himself. Got just as big a laugh when they tried the act out in Chatham. Eric made a bit more of the Jerry Lewis imitation, in spite of threatening noises from the producers of the movie, and they kept the Andrews sisters bit just as it was, with the girls wearing false noses as well as the dresses and the wigs, so the audience believed they were men in drag. So, when they snatched off the gingham dresses and were revealed as two smashing girls and a good-looking bloke, well, it was a coup de théâtre, as Harold Hobson might have said. They looked like Bucks Fizz or one of those. Benefiting from Stan's experience with himself, Eric put the girls under long-term contract, one of them for longer than he reckoned with, for they got married in America the following year. Yes, Eric got a coast-to-coast booking in the States without the assistance of an agent, thus saving 10%. There was an account of it in the Professional Weekly. Eric wrote it himself. I remember meeting Stan Rich in Shaftesbury Avenue a week or so after it came out. He was obviously a broken man. I asked after his brother Alan. He shrugged. No idea, he said. The act's finished, washed up. There is no act any more. The Rich brothers are dead. All due to me hiring a bloody amateur. He stopped and moved a bit closer to me. It was your bloody idea, wasn't it? But by that time I'd crossed the street against the lights and hurriedly mingled with the crowd on the other side. I hate scenes. If it made Stan feel any better to blame me, let him, I don't mind. But it's my opinion he deserved all he got. He'd been mean to Eric. And, of course, he couldn't sue him for stealing the material. That must have hurt worst of all. Because, as I told you at the beginning, Stan and his brother had stolen the material in the first place. From an act in Paris from the Bernard brothers, Jerry Lewis and half a dozen others. He didn't have a case. Of course, I admit Eric didn't really deserve the success he had handed to him on a plate, but you have to admire the way he was able to grab his chances with both hands. Later on, he bought property in Las Vegas and Florida just before the boom and made an even bigger fortune on Wall Street. I don't begrudge him any of that. But what rankles with me is that as a result of him leaving his mother flat as he did, she gave up running digs forever. Twice I've played Bradford since those days without the compensation of Mrs. Winthrop's digs. So both times I've stayed with a little woman in Halifax. If you know Halifax, you may wonder why. I mean, that I actually preferred staying there tells you something of how I feel about Bradford. If any listeners in Bradford resent these remarks, forget it. After all, Bradford always ignored me during my many visits in spite of blanket publicity, so why should anybody up there care what I think?